Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast, episode 142. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. If you haven't already, please take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and review. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you share with a friend, share with a family member who could find this valuable. If you leave a 5-star rating and review, I'll give you a shout out on the show. So I look forward to hearing from you. Big, big announcement. Our merch is officially out. A lot of work, a long time coming, but we got it all ready for you. So if you want to grab some merch, click the link below in the show notes. It will go fast. So click the link below, grab your merch today. I can't wait to hear what you think. Also, this episode, this was such a good episode. We got a brother who's 26 years old, developing properties in Houston from the ground up. He just got started a couple years ago. And so we're going to get into the nitty gritty of how he did it and how you could do it too. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Here with me, I have Donovan Adesero out of Houston. Donovan, thank you so much for joining the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. I'm honored to be here.
Definitely. And before we go any further into the episode, definitely make sure you subscribe. If you're on YouTube, if you're on Apple Podcasts, any of the audio outlets, leave us a 5-star rating, leave us a review, leave us a comment. I definitely will give you a shout out. If you do, leave a 5-star rating review. So I look forward to hearing from you. So Donovan, again, very excited for this interview. And I would love to talk about how you got into real estate development. The reason I want to start there is because you're 26 years old. And this is not something you usually hear from a 26-year-old. You might hear somebody is house hacking at that age or doing something else, but you're in real estate development. So talk to us about how you got into real estate development.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I got started when I was 24 now. So it's been about 2 years when the idea kind of first came to me. And so it's 2022 now. So it was basically during COVID when the whole idea came about. You know, I was working my engineering job and they sent us home. And so I had all this extra free time. So I was trying to figure out ways to make money. And, you know, if anyone's a Bigger Pockets listener, you know, they're all about burr, burr, burr. So I'm like, all right, I guess I got to find a flip or a burr. And, you know, as I was doing the numbers on those, I was like, okay, you may spend 20, 30 grand and hope to make 10 grand. I'm like, those margins are super tight for me, you know, hiring a general contractor. And so from there, I was like, it's got to make more sense to build, because what I was noticing was that the rehabbed properties would sell not too far under the new builds. And so to me, it made more sense to just go the new build route, because I know it almost sells itself, right? Like, I don't really have to compete with the flip. You're just competing with other new build. So, yeah, it's kind of got started. It made more sense than flips at the time.
Got it. So what was your first step? So it sounds like you discovered, all right, flips, the margins, the cash flow, the margins and the profits and this stuff are not adequate from what I'm looking for. And then you're like, all right, let me just build the whole thing from the ground up. Like, I think that's a pretty bold statement. And so I would love to hear, like, what did you do next? Like, what did that look like?
Yeah. Now looking back, I think it is probably a little crazy because it's been tough and ran into some challenges. But at the time, again, when you're naive and young and dumb, you don't know any better. You don't know how hard it's going to be. You just be like, oh, they're doing it down the street. Like, I don't see why I can't do it. So the first step for me was figuring out, okay, well, how much profit can I actually make? You know, in theory, it made sense in my head, but I didn't know the actual granular numbers. So the first step was to figure out, what is the land going to cost? And that's pretty simple. I just went on Zillow. Okay, what is stuff selling for? At the time, the area I was looking at, stuff was selling for like 40, 50 grand. Okay, so I got that number down. The land's 40, 50 grand. And then the toughest part was figuring out what it's actually going to cost to build. And so obviously that's tough, because general contractors, builders, they don't really want to talk to you until you have a project like ready to go. they don't really want to deal with hypotheticals, right? They want a project now they can work on. So, but after talking to a bunch of them, you can kind of get a gauge for what the cost was going to be. And so that was really key. And the way I did that was talking through basically contractors on real estate Facebook groups. So, you know, Houston Real Estate Investor Group or whatever. And then from there, it was to figure out what was it selling for, which is also pretty straightforward because you just look on Zillow. Okay, it was listed at 300. It's probably going to sell somewhere around 300, you know, maybe 290, you know, whatever. So that was the next step, was to piece together the total cost and what I could actually make.
Got it. So it sounds like the next step was, how much is land? How much does it cost to build? How much could you make? And the follow-up question I have is, were you looking just anywhere? Were there certain areas of Houston that you started your search in? And if it was a certain area, why that area?
Yeah, so I started in the area where I actually bought my duplex to house hack. So that's how I got into real estate, buying a duplex to house hack. And so in that area, it was one of the few places that I saw where new construction duplexes were selling for under 300 grand. This was in 2020, which, again, not selling for that anymore. They're like 400 now, but at the time, it was basically the most affordable. So I said, okay, because I think when you're a developer, you got to have an idea of who your end buyer is. Same thing with the flipper, I guess. You know, who's actually going to buy this thing when you're done with it. And so for me, my ideal buyer was someone like myself, maybe coming out of college, maybe someone a couple of years down, you know, into their first job, want to get a duplex. So for me, it was more about keeping that affordable price point. So that's why I focused on in Houston. It's called Medical Center South. That's what they rebranded it as. But people who are from Houston are like, dude, that's the hood. But again, I lived here. It's not that bad. So long story short, I wanted something affordable. I wanted to be 15, 20 minutes from downtown. So that was still accessible for people with jobs and, you know, just a desirable place in terms of location, like geographically, right? You know, if you're from Houston, we have a lot of sprawl, right? So you could be an hour outside of Houston, out of downtown Houston, and they'll still call it Houston. So my thing was being somewhat close to city center, affordable, and then non-flood. So those were kind of my three main criteria at the time.
Love it. And, you know, we're still in the beginning. One thing I'm realizing is you're an action taker. You're an action taker. You realize you didn't want to flip. You're like, there must be another way. Let me just build it from the ground up. You didn't hesitate. You didn't think too much about it, it seems. And you just started to figure out the different steps. So the location, what the cost is, just kind of setting the groundwork. And I think there's a lot people can take from that for any real estate endeavor you have. You know, sometimes you just have to go off your instinct and do the research after and figure out how to get to the goal. But if you wait, if you delay, you probably won't do anything. Or by the time you get up and want to do it, it's going to be too late. So I think it's great that, you know, you started the process once you had the thought.
No, I appreciate that. And yeah, that's a great point. If I was waiting until I knew everything, I would still be waiting, right? I mean, there's no substitute for taking action and kind of figuring out as you go. Obviously, you want to know a little bit what you're doing. So like, again, making sure the numbers work. And that's my big thing for people who want to get in development, is because there's so many unknowns, make sure you got a pretty solid profit margin so that, again, I knew I was going to make mistakes. I knew there's go over budget, whatever. Because I had that profit margin, I was like, okay, there's enough here to where when I inevitably mess up, we're still going to be okay and make money.
Definitely. So, you know, sound like you did some research, you found out, you know, some baseline information. So how did you find and fund that first lot or piece of land where you wanted to develop on?
Yeah. So, man, that first one was such a grind. So once I had all the pieces put together in terms of like the prices, so I had the land, I had the construction cost, I had, you know, what it's going to sell for, I had what I wanted to build. I put it all together in a presentation, kind of same way you do in high school or in college, you know, throw it in Google Slides. I don't think I could afford PowerPoint at the time. So I had it all together. I was like, okay, I got to find someone who has the money, because I don't have the money to buy the land or the money to find, you know, even put the down payment. So It was challenging because I went to just about everybody I knew who I thought had money, you know, whether it be coworkers, people, other investors that I knew, and pretty much all of them are like, you know, it sounds good, but like, you know, catch me on the next one, right? They didn't want to be the guinea pig, understandably so. And so I was reaching out to all these different people on real estate Facebook groups. Bigger Pockets Facebook group was one of them. Another one was like some apartment investing Facebook group. And just basically, again, this is like not what you're supposed to do, you know, sending out investor presentations. Like, I don't think that's allowed. But at the time, right, again, I didn't know anything, right? You don't know any better. So, but as I was going through these Facebook groups, I would particularly look for people who were investing or interested in investing out of state, because that told me they were okay with not having eyes on their property all the time. And so I knew that was like a starter for them potentially wanting to invest with me, because now they got someone boots on the ground. It can make them feel a little bit better about out of state investing, rather than, so if they're in California and they buy a property in Kansas City, they're just hoping the property manager is just taking care of it. Whereas in my case, they got someone, me, boots on the ground that they're texting, calling, can talk to. And so basically after getting like 50 plus, 60 plus no's, I finally get the one who's like, okay, I'll do it. Now, mind you, I had to give out pretty much, I think like 70-75% of the profit to get this done. But again, you got to do what you got to do to get started. So gave up almost all the profit. He funded the land. And then we closed on the construction loan. And then so that the construction was 100% financed. And then, yeah, off to the races from there. Once I got the first investor, leveraged that to get more investors and whatnot.
Got it. For that particular project, did you just need that one investor in construction loan? Was that sufficient, or did you have to raise more money?
Yeah. So for that, for each deal, I really only needed the one investor. At the time, I think the amount I needed was maybe like 60,000. I think the land was going to be like 40-ish, and then an extra 10 for plans and permitting, and then like a 10 kind of contingency sort of thing. So yeah, just 60,000. It could have came from multiple investors, but in this case, it just came from one.
Got it. So for a construction loan, when you're trying to develop a property, how does that process work?
Yeah, so there's really two ways you can go about it. You can buy the land in cash, and then the construction lender would basically cash you out of the land. So for example, you buy the land for 40 grand and construction lenders at the time were covering we'll just say 50% for easy numbers. They're covering 50% of the land. So they would give you back 50% of the land value at closing of the construction loan. So you get 25 grand back, obviously take out closing costs. Maybe you net like 10, 15 grand. The other option is to have the lender finance the land on the purchase. So they would cover 50% of the purchase. So if you're buying the land for 50,000, they're coming in with 25, you're coming in with 25 plus closing costs. So, and they wrap in the construction portion into that as well. So they'll cover a portion of the land plus all the construction generally.
Got it. So it sounds like it's a couple ways to go about it. And are these like banks? Are these individuals? Like how does that part of it work as well?
Yeah. So you can go, I guess there's really two, probably the biggest ways are going through a bank or going through like a hard money lender. So banks obviously are going to be cheaper. So less maybe fees, lower interest rate. The caveat there is you have to bring more money. So instead of you bringing maybe 25 grand to closing, maybe you have to bring like 40. So, you know, maybe 20, 30% more money or more cash needed versus a hard money lender. They're going to be more expensive, a little more fees, but you have to bring less cash. So at the time on the first one, to really mitigate the risk, we ended up going with the bank, right? Just to, again, there's so many things I didn't know and it was so potentially risky. We just went with the bank to keep the interest rate low, put more money in and just, yeah, went that route.
Got you. How does the bank qualify you in a situation like this? I mean, I'm assuming it's different than if you were getting like a property, a house hack. What is that process? What are some differences between getting a construction loan for development and getting like a mortgage loan, for instance?
Yeah, good question. So on a new construction or fix and flip, something like this, it's going to be more of a commercial loan. So commercial meaning they're going to want to generally lend to an LLC or some sort of entity. corporation, whatnot, some sort of entity, not just you and your personal name. So that's one. The benefit of that is obviously it's not going to go on your credit, right? So if anyone's wondering, well, how do all these developers get all these loans? None of these are on our credit. So if I get 50 construction loans, none of those go on my credit. So that's key. So it's not affecting your DTI. They don't really care about, again, like any debt you have, so to speak. They'll just really qualifying more so the deal rather than you as the borrower. They're qualifying you, like make sure your credit's decent and whatnot, but that's a big one. And then the other one is like on these commercial loans, you can't live in it. So you have to explicitly sign a document that says you won't occupy it. So some people say, well, you can refinance later into your own mortgage, but while you're building it, you obviously can't live in it, just to be clear. And then the other thing is because it's commercial and it's not on your credit, you pay for that in typically a higher rate. So let's say your home loan is at, nowadays it's at like 6.5%. A commercial construction loan is going to be like 7.5%. So you probably expect to pay another 100 basis points or 1% higher than what your current mortgage is on the rate, at least.
Got it. So you got the loan from the lender and you got the construction loan. This is your first development. Like, what did you do? Did you have a plan? Like, what happened from there?
Yeah, good question. So kind of not really, no. So really, I still remember the day when we closed on the land. I was like, oh my gosh, he actually sent the money. He wired the 40 grand for us to close on the land. I was like, just like in shock. I was like, okay, like, I guess we're doing this. And so then it was just kind of full steam ahead with I had put like a plan to place in the beginning. And it, obviously that goes well until you get kind of punched in the mouth or something else comes that surprises you. So in this case, we just followed what I'd originally planned in terms of like, I knew the rough square footage of what I wanted to build. So we bought the land. I sent the survey kind of closing docs to the architect. And that way he can work on fitting the duplex or whatever structure you want to build onto the land. And then from there, he'll send it to you saying, hey, everything looks good. I'm like, yep, looks good. Go ahead and submit it to the city. So it was nice to be able to outsource some of those things, because if I were to do it, again, me trying to figure it out is just kind of a waste of time. So outsource that, the plans and permitting. And then while we're waiting on that, we're kind of arranging the financing, because in our case, we had bought the land in cash. So we didn't close on the loan until we actually had the permits approved. So basically bought the land cash, sent it to the architect. He put the structure on it, make sure it fits and whatnot, sent it to us for review. We sign off on it, and then he submits it to the city. And then once we're about to get the permits, that's pretty much when we close on the construction loan. So that was the next step from there. And then it was kind of letting the GC know, getting the GC contract in place, making sure, again, at the time, I just pretty much really found one off of Google. Don't do that. Like, just spend the money and actually get a real contract. I'll send someone a contract if you need it. So that wasn't good. But again, I was trying to save as much money as possible, because I was like, I don't know where I'm going to go wrong here. So I need to keep the profit margin. I was being super cheap on those first few. So then once we close on the loan, then kind of hand the plans to the GC, you got the permits. Now it's kind of off to the races.
Got it. So the architect that designs it, make sure the structure that he's designing can fit on the space that you have. And then it's submitted to the city. What is the city looking for to approve the plans to build what the architect designed?
Yeah. So the city, again, cities across America, I was going to say specific to Houston, but it's pretty much across America. They're looking to making sure you're adhering to the international building code. So one of the things you're looking for is, okay, do you have a window in each bedroom, right? If it's not you can't call it a bedroom if it doesn't have a window, which is called a egress, a way to get out of it, essentially. So like a bedroom needs to have a window, needs to have a closet, needs to be like a certain space. So they're looking for things like that, making sure you're meeting all the building requirements. They're looking to make sure you're not violating any, it could be some restriction, like making sure you didn't put the structure too far in front, right? So what's called a survey will tell you this. It's called a setback. It tells you when you can actually start your structure. So you might have a 25-foot setback, which means the first 25 feet from the front of the lot is your front yard, and you can't put the structure until there. You might have a 35-foot setback. So they're looking to make sure you adhere to the code. Houston's generally been pretty good about permitting times. Here it's about like, used to be about 4 months. Now it's getting more towards like 6 months on average. But I would say definitely check with your architect on what the rough estimate on permitting times is, because they can vary greatly. You know, if you're in LA where you are, it's probably more like, I think I know a guy who was working on a single family new development. It took him like 2 years to get permits. So
sounds about right.
So you definitely want to know like the rough timeline ahead of, you know, before you go ahead and buy land and just try to do it, which definitely. I did in my case.
That makes sense. So it sounds like it's about a 4 or 5 month timeline for you before you're even able to like put a shovel on the ground.
Yeah, at least, because you may be spending, let's say you buy in the land today, you may spend 30 days or so going back and forth with the architect before you even submit to the city. And then once you submit to the city, it's another 4 months, 5 months. So in my kind of performas, I usually plan to not break ground till like month six. And then in my case, we plan to not finish until like month 12. So that's about what you can approximate if you're in Houston. Again, it varies greatly depending on permitting times. That's what I was projecting. Sorry, actually I lied. My first project, I think I projected like 9 months and I was way off. It was more like 12, 13 wow. months. So I was off there as well. Again, I budgeted, you know, there's a lot of profit margin, so we were good, but just listing all the mistakes so that way your viewers can be like, yeah, don't be like Donovan.
Got you. You mentioned a word that we haven't really heard much on the show, performer. Can you explain what that is, like a basic definition?
Yeah, performer just really means like, I guess your general kind of business plan with maybe the numbers laid out. So performer is really just like a fancy word for really, what are you going to do and what the numbers look like? So again, my presentation on Google Slides was like 7 slides long. You could call that a performa, but like, again, it's just a fancy word for like, what were you going to do? I just listed out, you know, where the property is, what the numbers are going to be, what can an investor expect to make, what the rough timeline was. So just like a summary of the deal, more or less.
Got it. So 12, 13 months pass and then you get rolling. What was it like managing that whole project? Were you still at the job at the time? Was the GC kind of taking things and going like, what was that all like?
Yeah, good question. So yeah, I was still at my engineering job this entire time while we were buying the land, while we started construction and all that. So yeah, my idea of it was that the GC would just take over and, you know, shouldn't be an issue. He should just be building it. He knows what to do. I shouldn't really have to monitor him. And I was greatly wrong. I can tell you that right now. You should be there, especially on your first one. You should be there, I'd say, multiple times a week, and you should be talking to the contractor like almost daily. Like, what are you working on now? What's coming up next? Just so you can get ahead of potential issues. So, so I would go there after work. I would call him and just try to see how things are going. The problem for me was I would go there and I'd be like, okay, so we're working on cabinets, for example. When are they going to be in? Oh, they'll be in next week. And next week we come around. Oh, yeah, I think maybe another week or two. And it kind of dragged down like that with the first contractor. And I say first contractor for a reason, because there's some foreshadowing right there. See where this is going. And so a lot of things were getting just kind of pushed to the back burner in terms of like timelines, like our original agreed upon timeline. And so essentially what was going on was that he had kind of took on some more profitable projects where he was basically spending all his time there instead of on mine, which again, like, he's not a terrible person in the world for doing it. Like, I get it, but obviously for me, you're not adhering to our agreement. So ultimately ended up having to fire the first contractor basically midway through, which was not a good look, right? My investor's like, okay, this dude has no idea what he's doing. So that was a real tough situation, but got the new contractor in there, finished it, and now it's all good. You know, investor made a bunch of money, so he's happy. I noticed, like, you make someone money, it usually solves whatever past thoughts they had about you. They go away a little bit. So, again, this all circles back to making sure you have profit margin in your deal, so that when things like this inevitably go wrong, you're all right.
Got it. So you finished the first duplex, right?
Yep.
Finished the first duplex. What did your all-in cost roughly end up being, and how much were you able to sell it for?
Yeah. So the first one, we were all in at maybe like 250 ish, and we were under contract at 300. We were under contract for a while. Again, part of the delays were partly on me. Like, who knew you had to order a water meter a month in advance? Not me. So we were just sitting there for a month waiting for water meters. But anyways, we're under contract for like 300. We ended up, by the time we finished the project and ready to sell, the buyer didn't have like his financing in order. We're like, dude, this property is worth like 320 at least now. So it's like, it benefits you to make sure you have your kind of stuff in order to close on this thing. And he's like, oh no, give me like 2 weeks. And we're like, no, that's not fair to us. We've been waiting we let you know it's going to be like, you've had 2 months. Like, we were under contract for 2 months. So he had plenty of time to kind of get his stuff in order, but he didn't. So we ended up refinancing the property, renting it out, ended up being great, because we pulled out almost all the investors' money. And then we were cash flowing like $1,000 a month. So ended up being a really solid deal. But a lot of challenges for sure.
Definitely.
So yeah,
definitely.
We're all in. Go ahead. Oh, sorry.
Definitely. So it sounds like you rented it out. Here's what I want to know. Like, how did it feel just after all the challenges you had to go through? I'm not sure how long the whole entire project took, but how did it feel when it was just done?
Yeah, it was great feeling for sure. And so I think I may have mixed up like two of the properties, because we had started like three at the same time. So one of them actually finished in 9 months, which is pretty good. The second one ended up taking like 13, 14 months, which was not good. But the first one was, yeah, it was such a relief. I think the whole entire time I was half expecting in my mind for something to just, like, for it to just blow up out of nowhere. Like, I couldn't visualize the property being done and us like exiting it. I figured it'd catch on fire. It was something. But yeah, I remember like when we were working on the refinance and waiting for that to close and like walking through the property, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess we made it. But at the same time, I think that's a good feeling to have, right? Because I have, you know, other people's money at stake. So you should be nervous, in my opinion. You should want to perform for them and make sure, you know, you're doing kind of what you said you did. So yeah, it was a great feeling to get the investor almost all their money back and then get them a bunch of cash flow at the end as well.
Definitely, definitely. Love it. And so you said you were doing three at the same time?
Yeah, I think we started like three or four, almost maybe within a couple weeks of each other.
With the same investor, or did you have like other investors?
Yeah, so I had two investors. One investor had like three properties and the second investor had one. So we started like those four around the same time, all with the same contractor.
Wow. The same, like, one that you ended up firing?
Yes.
Wow. How did you find someone else to take on all four of those properties that you were working on?
Yeah, it's a good question. So really what was happening was the original contractor, he was basically subcontracting it out to another builder, essentially. So it'd be like, imagine you and me both work at Target. I'm not really showing up doing my work. I'm just having you, I'm paying you to do my work, and we're splitting my basically paycheck. So that's essentially what was happening. And so I basically said, well, let's just cut out the middleman, because I had a contract, right, with the original GC. So I could only pay him. And so that was causing like tension. So because he would take the money and not necessarily pay all of it to the subcontractor. And so obviously he's upset. And so we cut out the middleman essentially by firing that GC. Then it said subcontractors basically promoted to GC. Hey, you're doing all the work anyways. You have all the relationships with the subs. So now you're the new contractor. So we signed a new agreement with him and he was able to finish them. And it's been going pretty well. Not perfect, but been going pretty well.
Got it. Something that people may not know, can you explain the relationship between the general contractor and the subcontractor and like what that means?
Yeah. So general contractor is mainly the person who, when I say have relationships, like the plumber, right? So the plumber isn't necessarily, they're not going off generally to get their own jobs. They're usually, they may do some side jobs here and there, but I think usually the bulk of their work probably is through some relationships they have with general contractors. So say, you know, a good plumber, you know, a good electrician, you know, a good HVAC guy. You could really, in essence, become a general contractor because you have the trades that are good and they will respond and come do work for you kind of when you ask. And so that's really all that takes. General contractor is more of like a just glorified manager, right? Sometimes they can do work. Like in my case, my GC he can do work as well. Sometimes they're more of like a just delegator. Yeah, it's important to make sure your contractor has, you know, some relationships with other, you can call them subcontractors or just other contractors in general who can do quality work, because anyone who's been in construction knows that you call one guy, probably some days he just won't show up for like a week, right? So you need to have obviously ideally multiple kind of options you can choose from.
Definitely. So you were working on four properties at the same time. How many have you built to date?
Yeah, to date we finished 8. We had started off with like 4 at the time, and then we started like another 4 or 5. We finished 8 right now, and then we started like another 10 about like maybe last month or so.
Wow. So you scaled up pretty quickly, and you started 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel quickly. It feels like a grind, but the goal, I think we have a repeatable model that I think makes sense and that we've shown we can execute on. So we're going to just kind of hammer that until it doesn't work anymore.
What is that secret sauce? What is it that you're able to replicate? Because I mean, you talked about some of the challenges you have with those first few, and you've done 8, and you have, I think you said another 10 in the pipeline. So what is it that's working, that's helping you to be able to repeat and to scale?
Yeah, for sure. I think a big one for me is optimizing the floor plan for square footage in particular. So I think it's easy to look at development as a kind of cool, sexy thing. You build beautiful projects, you know, fancy, I don't know, sunroof, or you got light coming in from the roof or whatever, just all these fancy things. But the key that I think people need to understand is there's a difference between what people want and what people will pay for. Very big difference. So for example, I would love to own a $10 million mansion. I will not buy a $10 million mansion because I don't have the money. And so it's the same kind of concept or thinking with spec building, which is what we do. So it's a lot of people will say, yeah, I want a duplex that's, I don't know, 2,000 square feet each side. I wanted to have 5 bedrooms and 3 bathrooms. It's like, okay, I can build that, but you understand that's going to cost you like $600,000. You're like, yeah, you know, it sounds good. And then you may build it, get all the way into the point where you're ready to sell. You'll, okay, hey, buyer, ready to go? Oh, you know, I mean, see, my dog just got sick, so I don't think I could buy that right now. Just all these things where it's like, you won't get maybe the return that you originally thought. So I guess being mindful of, again, what people will pay for and what they want. So I try to find, you know, kind of thread that needle of like, okay, so I will give you a 3-bedroom, 2-bath duplex, but I will not make it oversized so that you could fit, you know, 3 families and 2 dogs in there. It'll be just enough to fit a mom, dad, or mom, whoever, and then 2 kids or 2 kid bedrooms or whatever. So it's optimizing for something else. And so in my case, I optimize for bedrooms with minimizing the square footage. So kind of breaking it down to a science so that you're not, just willy-nilly building stuff and with no idea of like who your end buyer is and what the market can actually support. So basically just go off data when you decide what to build and not like feelings.
Got it. So what's your typical bed bath for each unit and square footage?
Yeah, so we have basically two floor plans that we've mainly built so far. One of them is a two bedroom, two bath each side. It's about 1800 square feet total. So 900 square feet each side. And then we have a three bedroom, two bath option, which is about like 1150 each side. So I think it's like 2300 square feet. So to give you and your viewers kind of an idea of like the disparity is like, there's a 3000 square foot duplex. It's three bedroom, two bath. And I have my duplex. It's three bedroom, two bath, but it's 2300 square feet. So 700 square feet less. And we are getting the same rents. So we're getting the same rents at 700 less square feet, which in Houston, 700 square feet times, you know, $100 per square foot build cost is 70 grand. So I can get the same rents as my competition, but I'm spending 70K less on building. So my returns will be higher and I'll have a lot more margin in the deal. So that's just a kind of more of an extreme example, but just an idea of like, just because you need three bedroom, two bath doesn't mean you have to make it that big.
Got it. That makes sense. And so you mentioned that one of the first four, you ended up refinancing and renting out. Is that the model that you do, like refinance, pay off the investors and rent it out? Is it a mix of doing that and also selling them? Like, what's the strategy?
Yeah, it's a mix of both. So ideally, my goal would be to hold as many as possible. At the same time, especially now, right, with the higher interest rates, it's going to make it tougher to get the cash flow. We can still cash flow a little bit, but it may make sense to just exit some of these. The other thing too is I wanted to set some comps for what we're building, right? So what we did was purposely sold some of the three bedroom, two bath, the first two that we built, we sold them. So now I've established a comp so that now when I refi, I say, hey, appraiser, we actually built that one right there. So just saying, if you're looking for a comp, we also built that one. So I already know what the appraisal is going to come in at because we already sold we are our own comps at this point because we're building such a small geographical area. So if we can hold them and still cash flow, my goal is to do that. But it's looking like right now we made just more sales, which is fine as well.
Love it. Are these properties all in the same area? Like, did you end up buying, you know, lots next to each other? Like, how has that worked out?
Yeah. So the tough part about the area where we're buying in is that there's like different owners almost every lot. So it's really tough to get continuous lots because, again, there's just so many different owners. Usually it's like the neighbor or the guy who owns the house also owns his lot next door. And it just goes on like that forever. So it's hard to get multiple lots because you're dealing with multiple sellers. So pretty much all of our lots have been separate, like scattered, but they've been scattered within the same zip code. So we're probably all within like a 2.5, all 20, 25 lots. Well, I guess like two of them are like outside of the zip code, but I'd say 20 plus lots are within like a 2-mile radius. So they're not next to each other, but the key is to have them close enough where I can lead the appraiser to use them as a comp. So just because they're not next to each other doesn't necessarily hurt me. Again, they just need to be close enough where it'll benefit me on the appraisal.
That makes sense. So it sounds like it's definitely a strategy there. And so how does it feel to just be filling a need in the city? You know, I know one of the things that I saw on your page, or one of the things, as a matter of fact, that you sent me in your bio actually, is that you realized that there was a shortage of duplexes in the city. So talk to us more about that.
Yeah, so it's been awesome because, you know, it's filling a need for, again, people like myself. I think it's house hacking is honest. Again, you guys have talked about this on your show, but yeah, probably the best way to get started if you're young, old, almost anyone, and especially if you're coming out of college or whatnot and got a good job. So it's nice to be able to provide, you know, future house hacks to someone who's going to start their kind of financial journey to financial freedom. And then obviously the nice part too for them is that the property's under warranty, right? So it's like you don't really have to worry about stuff breaking or fixing stuff because you know, okay, yeah, it's under warranty. Call Donovan, he'll send his contractor to come fix it. So that's been super cool to kind of witness, and looking forward to hopefully, you know, providing some more house hacks to people.
Definitely. I love it. What are some of the challenges you've had? What are some of the mistakes that you've made over the past couple of years?
Yeah, challenges. I think everyone has the challenges with like contractors and whatnot. So I want to try to touch on some different challenges. So I guess some of the big ones, they're not actually big, but they're more of like a series of little ones. So within development, there's so many little things that you can't really Google, right? So like I briefly mentioned earlier, like how do I know when I need to order the water meter? No idea, right? You can't really Google that. It's not something you can find out, or where do I get a water meter in Houston? Again, you can talk to some people and that's how you find out, but there's little things like that. And so I'd say that same thing kind of translates as well to like utilities. Where do you find, you know, how do you get an electric meter? Who do you call for that? If you need, if you're having issues, could be a lot of things. So yeah, I mean, those are the big ones where I'm saying it's more of like these little things that you can't really, you just have to go through them to really, really know them. But luckily kind of rely on your team. You ask around, be willing to look dumb. Sometimes you'll just call the city and just ask like, hey, I think I did this on my first one. I say, hey, like, how do I get an electric meter? I think I called the electric department. They're like, oh yeah, you do this and this. So, yeah, Houston's been really good to like calling the permitting department. And generally I think whatever city you're in, it's really good to just call them and get a feel for stuff. So, one of the ways that I realized that I couldn't build but didn't want to build like a triplex or a fourplex, because people always ask me, you know, why don't you build those? Because I called the city and asked like, what are the requirements? They're like, okay, well, if you do that, if you go over 2 units, you get into commercial building code. And so you're going to need a fire suppression system. You're going to need a turnaround, meaning you need to be able to turn around an emergency vehicle. And so there's all these different things that came up just by making a simple call to the permitting department, asking a question, is kind of listening. So yeah, those are some of the main challenges, but you just figure them out by being willing to look dumb. It's my specialty.
Definitely. And I was going to ask you about the duplex versus building higher. And it makes sense. It sounds like it would be a lot more expensive. There's a lot more restrictions. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, you know, you're rolling with the duplexes now.
Yeah. So like you said, it's just, it's going back to the thing that I said of like what people are willing to pay for versus, you know, what the market really supports. So if I were to build a fourplex, it would probably cost me at least like 600 to 700,000, which means I'd have to sell it like 850. And, you know, in LA, that's like cheap, right? But in Houston, average home price is like 300 grand. So like 850, you're more than doubled, almost triple what people's kind of budget is. And so you won't be able to sell it, and the rents won't justify you refinancing it. So again, it's one of the things, just kind of looking at the data to making an informed decision of why. That's why I stick to duplexes, because of that exact reason.
Definitely. What are a couple of mistakes you've made over the past couple of years?
Yeah. So one of the mistakes, I think doing more due diligence on, I talk about this all the time, the contractor. I'm trying to not sound like a broken record. But that's one. I think willing to bring in help, I would say, or willing to ask questions. I think sometimes I try a little too hard to just figure stuff out on my own, when really making a call to say my architect or another investor I know could have really simplified the answer, or at least got me to the answer quicker. So I think be willing to maybe be vulnerable and kind of rely on that team or your network, people you know. So that's a big one. I think another one, mistake or honestly wish we would have bought even more land than we did whenever it was 2020, because now the prices have like doubled at least. So I'd say, like, when you realize the numbers make sense and we're attractive, you know, pull the trigger and don't, now be mindful of like your capabilities and whatnot for sure, but be willing to kind of take a risk, because I mean, there's no other way to really get where you want to go without doing it. So yeah, those two for sure.
Definitely. Definitely. What does the future look like? What are some things you want to do? Do you want to continue just building as many duplexes as possible? What are your thoughts as far as the future of your business?
Yeah, good question. Honestly, I think about this a lot, and I really don't even have a solid answer. I'm leaning more towards the model of if it's not broken, don't fix it, because especially as we head into the higher interest rate environment, maybe a little not as smart to just go and try things willy-nilly as it was maybe a year ago. You could have done something completely out of your maybe your expertise, and you still probably would have did okay. But now I think it's a lot more risk has been added. So I want to eventually build maybe either like a subdivision of some sort. So whether it be a bunch of duplexes or a bunch of single families, but just something where, you know, take the land from basically, again, bare land to completed housing. Whereas what we're doing now is called more of like infill development, where you're just buying a lot that this house is kind of next to it. Utilities are already there. You're not so much, the risk is a lot less, there's a lot less risk there because of that. So yeah, I'd like to do something bigger projects basically.
Love it. Love it. Can't wait to hear about that in the future. How do you manage everything? Cause you have 10 plus projects going on at the same time, I believe. Are you still balancing that with your job as well? And just how do you manage everything?
Yeah. So yeah, I guess I neglected to say that I left my engineering job basically January of this year, 2022, to work as a essentially hard money lender to provide fix and flip and new construction. So that's been my full-time job, you know, since beginning of the year. And that's been nice because it's a sales role. And so it works pretty well because I'm basically looking for other people like myself who are doing new construction or doing fix and flips and who need financing. So that's been nice to not only grow my network, but also, again, it's my job. So it goes along with what I'm doing compared to, you know, finding how do I get oil out of the ground. It's not as relatable to my duplexes. So that's been helpful because I get to work remotely. So I get to still, you know, manage stuff on the side. Like if I need to run quickly to the site or something, it's doable. The other thing too, where, yeah, how I manage it, I don't know if I'm managing it well. I'm still figuring it out as I go. But luckily, all the developments are, again, like I said, within like a 2 mile radius. So I can hit them all in 30, 45 minutes. And so that's been super helpful, that not traveling all over the city. And the other thing is just kind of trying to get systems in place. So, for example, one of the systems that I try to work on is the kind of accounting bookkeeping of it. So, you know, as you can imagine, with different investors, you have different LLCs, you have different money flowing in and out of them from construction draws, you're paying your GC, okay, how much is left? So just getting in a app like Wave, you know, that lets you kind of import and automatically import transactions, and you can kind of assign a category to them. So a lot of just hopefully little maybe technology hacks or technology options to solve some of those problems help save a lot of time. I had a virtual assistant at one point. Ended up just letting them go because I would need them for like a week or two, and then they wouldn't have anything to do for like 2 weeks. So I'm still trying to figure out what the right balance is for that. But for now it's just, you know, working hard and figuring out as I go.
Definitely, definitely. So one of the things as well that I noticed about you is that you are figuring things out as you go. You're jumping into stuff and finding the resources, questions, and asking questions and stuff like that. What would you say to somebody who wants to get into development? Is there anything you would tell them to do that's maybe different than what you've done? Is there anything you tell them to do that's similar to what you've done? Like, what's some advice you would give to somebody who sees you like, wow, you know, this brother's in Houston, he's young, he's building houses, he's improving the community. What would your advice be?
Yeah, for sure. I think ideally I would work for a developer if possible. And that's probably the path of least resistance. So, you know, if you're in Houston or any, pretty much any big market, actually, you can probably get a job for D.R. Horton, Lennar, some of those bigger public builders. And you may not learn all the little details, but I think you'll get a feel for it and you'll at least maybe meet some trades, right? There could be a lot of just, synergies, I guess is what I'm getting at in terms of meeting trades, meeting construction managers, meeting general contractors. It could be good. So that would be maybe number one, if possible. The other one would be to, if you can build up your own capital enough to get started, that would probably be ideal. Again, like kind of doing what I did, raising money from essentially someone you don't know, maybe wasn't ideal. But again, at the time, I still think I felt comfortable because the numbers made so much sense. So as long as the numbers make sense, I feel, you know, don't feel intimidated to go and ask for, you know, partnership, whether, you know, capital of some sort. So in that sense, I think being willing to take action and just ask is couldn't hurt as well. And then, like I said, just focus on what people will pay for versus, you know, what the market will actually support. If you kind of do those things, like, I think you'll have a solid business plan.
Definitely, definitely. And this is maybe not a joke, but maybe you also want to build in the city that doesn't have a million and one restrictions.
Very key. Very key. Yeah. I feel terrible for all my developer friends I know in LA. Matter of fact, to give you guys an example for, this is a much bigger deal, but I think a guy I met on Twitter, for those of you who aren't on Twitter, there's a huge real estate community on Twitter. And we had a conference where we met each other. He was working on like an 800 unit apartment building, and he's been working on it for 8 years, and he just got the approval to build. So now he still has to go and raise the financing and get the permitting. Like, he doesn't even have any plans. Just got the, okay, you can build 800 units there. You still got to go through the architect and get the plans. That's going to take like another 6 to 9 months. So yeah, like be kind of, you know, I guess cognizant of where you're, what jurisdiction you're in, and then what the timelines are, because that can be rough. You know, he told his investors it was going to be 4 and it's been 8. So not ideal.
Imagine having to convince people to stay down for 4 years. That's rough. But hopefully they're still in it.
Yeah, he's experienced, so he's done well. Like it made sense for him. But you know, if you're starting out, like you're trying to do that, that's going to be a tough sale.
Well, depending where you're at, if this is what you want to do, you might have to move.
You might have to, or just invest out of state, right? Get someone like me who's boots on the ground. And I think that's what a lot of people kind of do. For example, my first investor is from New Jersey. So he's dealing with the same kind of jurisdiction where it's going to take years to get approval. In my case, it was quick. The numbers made sense. He was like, yeah, I'll just put the money behind it. So you can find people like that. You can be the both sides of it. You could be a person who wants to place capital or a person who needs capital. Just kind of figure out where you fit in there.
Love it. Love it, man. This has been a really, really cool episode. You know, I think it's just amazing how much you've been able to accomplish at a young age and simply by just going for it. You know, it took over a year to get the first one done and the first couple of done. And now, you know, you have a number of deals in the pipeline. When it's all said and done, you'll be at 20 or so duplexes built. And I think it's great because not only obviously, you know, you are profiting, your investors are profiting, you're also filling a need in the community. You know, a lot of cities these days are getting more dense and they need more housing. So I think it's great that not only are you building houses, you're building duplexes. So like you said, people can house hack, you know, or maybe have their family on the other side or whatever the case may be. But I think it's a great thing. And, you know, I know this is just the beginning for you. So I can't wait to see, you know, do the follow-up episode and see where you're at. But, you know, I really appreciate you, Donovan, taking some time, sharing your story transparently. Definitely appreciate it, man.
I appreciate you. So honored to be here. So looking forward to connecting with you down the road here.
Definitely. Anything else you want to leave with the people? Also let them know as well where they can find you, where they can tap into everything you have going on.
Yeah. So on Twitter, I'm at Donovan Builds. I try to get really in detail. Like I share my numbers. I share everything like super in depth there. On Instagram, Donovan_651, just kind of share some highlights and like some of my mistakes I go through. So definitely shoot me a DM on there if I can help out.
Love it. Thanks again, man. And thank you everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Again, make sure you subscribe, make sure you like, leave us a 5-star rating, leave us a review, share this with your friends, share this with somebody who could find this useful. Thank you all so much. I look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bread Podcast. That's BRED Podcast. Until next time.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.